Hello, this is episode number 36 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Friday, February 15th, 2008. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On this week's show, we're going to be catching up on a variety of hot technology policy issues that have been in the news in recent weeks. Specifically, we'll get a quick update on the heated ongoing battle over net neutrality and broadband network management policy issues before the FCC. We'll also discuss the politics of a possible Microsoft-Yahoo merger. And finally, we'll have a few things to say about recent efforts to regulate video games. Joining me for today's discussion are some of our regular contributors at the TLF. First, we have Cord Bloomquist of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hi, Cord.
Hey, Adam.
Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
And Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute. Hi, Hans.
Hey.
Hans, let me begin with you. Net neutrality has been in the news again in a big way this week, with activity at the FCC and also in Congress. Can you begin by giving us a brief summary of what's been happening this week and why it's important?
Okay. Well, this week the FCC received comments on two petitions that were filed in November urging the FCC to set clear and transparent rules that would prevent network operators from degrading any traffic over their networks. Basically, what the FCC is being asked to do here is to prevent any network operator from prioritizing any traffic, since by definition, if you can't degrade something, you can't prioritize something else. So in effect, this would, if the FCC were to follow these two petitions, it would basically have to outlaw network management of any type.
And then explain to us what happened on the Hill as well with the Markey bill.
Well, Congressman Markey for months now has been signaling that he's working on legislation, this legislation was supposed to be introduced in January, but Markey had trouble finding a single Republican who would co-sponsor it with him. He finally found one, so we now have the bill introduced this week, and it represents a dramatic departure in tactics. Markey's not proposing any longer that Congress pass a law to ensure net neutrality. Instead, he's just proposing that Congress request the FCC to conduct a study similar to the study that's already been performed by the Federal Trade Commission. And secondarily, he's proposing that Congress enact a statement of policy that the Internet ought to remain free and open. Actually, he's got four policy statements. They're mutually contradictory.
It seems to me an important point to make here is that the preamble of the bill, even though it's supposed to be FCC studying or investigating the issue, the preamble of the bill seems to be predisposed to the idea that the FCC should be actively sort of micromanaging or at least constantly overseeing this broadband marketplace. Is that not correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Adam. I mean, one of the policies states that there can be no discrimination, whether it's reasonable or unreasonable. And another says that we have to not only preserve the open and interconnected nature of broadband networks, including the Internet, but also promote them.
And I noticed that there was even a clause that dealt with pricing and wondering about if pricing would be discriminatory, even though, of course, price discrimination, as economists define it, is a normal part of an efficient marketplace. So that raises the specter of potential FCC price controls, does it not?
It certainly does, but then I'll just cite one other policy statement here, which says that the Internet needs to remain a vital force in the United States economy. So, I mean, one could argue that in order for that to happen, it has to turn a profit so that it can sustain further investment. And in order to do that, pricing can't be cost-based. It has to be value-based. So it seems to me that you could argue that deregulatory policy is at least more useful here than not. And so they're a little bit mutually contradictory. But Adam, I want to just make one final point. I mean, as any lawyer knows, declarations, findings, statements of policy by Congress are not enforceable. They're of interest. I mean, certainly in a litigation setting, a judge who's trying to decide what the law means, and of course this isn't going to be law, but decide what the law means, may or may not find this language helpful. And so I had a professor in law school who once claimed that this stuff was meaningless. And that might be a bit exaggerated, but the reason Markey's proposing a statement of policy is because he doesn't have the votes to pass a law. And
right.
He's hoping that people won't be quite so concerned about a policy. And does this mean that we shouldn't oppose it? I mean, certainly not. But
right.
Hey, I have a question for Hans.
Hans, you said that the petition before the FCC was asking that network management be made, but you know that the result would be that network management would be made illegal, whether reasonable or not. And again, you said the Markey bill would sort of prohibit discrimination, whether reasonable or not. Is that really right? I mean, don't they leave some wiggle room for you know reasonable network management in either of these?
Well, in the Markey bill, I'll just cite the Markey bill. It says unreasonable interference or discrimination. Yeah, you could argue that unreasonable maybe applies to both those terms, but I could argue that it doesn't.
I mean, what seems to me, though, is that if you set – even if you leave the wiggle room for reasonable network management, you then introduce the FCC into having to be the judge of what is reasonable network management. And that, to me, is even more pernicious.
Right. I mean, we learned in the implementation of the 96 Telecom Act that the FCC cannot perform the role of a market referee without spawning a torrent of regulation, costly litigation, and years of uncertainty.
Cord, let's turn to you because CEI filed some comments at the FCC this week in the Comcast issue dealing with the network management policy issues. Tell us a little bit about what CEI had to say.
The underlying thing we said was that the economics just don't pan out. If people aren't allowed to manage their network this way, especially in the face of something like BitTorrent, it degrades the experience for most customers. People aren't going to pay for these services, and the development of the internet in general just be hindered.
Right. Yeah, we filed as well. Progress for Freedom Foundation did. My colleagues Ken Faree and Brett Swanson, and we tried to make the point in those comments that, you know, network management policies are routine in every single type of network industry, and that if we're going to have the FCC engage in this regard and become have an oversight role or even more active a regulatory role, there's a real legitimate danger that that's going to have some serious costs in terms of innovation and investment in future network, the kind of networks we need for the future. So, you know, I think this has been a really interesting proceeding. There's a lot of really good comments flowing into the FCC on all sides. But what's really interesting to me is that even the critics, even the sort of net neutrality proponents, are admitting that, yes, there does need to be some network management policies. It's just that they want to have a greater say about what those policies are than the companies, or at least have some sort of a check every time a company changes its policies.
You know, what I'm afraid of, Adam, is that that is such a reasonable position, right? Objectively, mm-hmm. when you hear it, and I especially would think of the Center for Democracy and Technology's comments to the proceeding, you know, they sort of acknowledge what Cord just said. You know, these companies need to make money, you know, these companies need to manage their networks. But then they say, you know, all we're asking for is that it has to be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a reasonable position to take. But the problem is, you know, when the FCC starts having to go you know, line by line and figure out what these, you know, and Richard Bennett made a great point, which is it's reasonable can only be judged in context. And it's such a dynamic,
right.
you know, situation that, you know.
Well, we've had these wars before, right? And Hans is certainly probably better versed to comment on this than the rest of us because he's had to deal with it both when he was on the Hill and then in industry. I mean, the fact is we've had debates about what reasonable is in terms of costs in the world of telecommunications for decades. But in the 90s, we had this grand experiment with what reasonable network interconnection policies and pricing would be. Is that not correct, Hans?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean and you were there too, and we both learned that reasonable meant whatever the FCC wanted it to mean.
And a lot of lawyers wanted it to mean.
Yeah, and we learned that
the FCC had that one, the first local competition order. I forget how many pages that was, Hans, but it totaled, you know, 700-some pages with some thousands of footnotes and then took 10 years of litigation. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And over the course of a decade, we saw that the FCC took opposite positions and was, you know, frequently upheld by the courts in both instances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any more on that, guys?
Can I make one point? It's already FCC policy that reasonable network management applies. And so really the question is, what about what Comcast did to BitTorrent? I mean, what do you guys think? Was it reasonable or unreasonable?
Well, I mean, I personally think it was reasonable. I think they should have disclosed what they were doing probably a little bit better. But again, I go back to what Richard Bennett said, which is that to judge whether something is reasonable or not, you need to know the context, right? What was the network load at that moment that they chose to do this? And the petitioners didn't supply that information.
Well, Jerry, let me ask you this. On the disclosure point, which we've discussed this on previous podcasts, and you and I agree that there probably needs to be some added disclosure by broadband operators to the extent that they engage in these practices. But I was very persuaded by Richard Bennett's arguments and others that, you know, you can't require a company to essentially give away their network management playbook to the rest of the world, or else it's very easy then to defeat whatever practices or policies they put in place. So how far would you have the FCC go in terms of requiring disclosure?
Well, as far as we are right now, right? The AP revealed that Comcast was using reset packets to do this sort of thing, and we know this now. And nothing, I mean, this does not affect, I mean, this does not giving the technical details of what they're doing, right?
Right.
So we just know that this is happening. We know why this is happening. We know when it happens, what specific network situations are, you know, take place that will trigger this. So that's all you need.
Right.
You know, you just need to basically tell your customers, you know, you can use BitTorrent, but please expect that if this situation, you know, if these set of factors come together, you might expect to some delays on your uploading.
Right. So to wrap this conversation up on this part, I just want to ask you guys to predict, you know, is there any chance that this Markey legislation that was introduced this week, any chance that goes anywhere at all? Hans?
I would say less than 50-50.
Cord or Jerry, any predictions on that one?
Well, when President Obama and the new Congress come in, I think that there's going to be a very good chance that this sort of thing is going to move.
Yeah, that's a good point. We should mention that that Senator Obama has already endorsed net neutrality principles and made it a major part, in fact, the first point in his technology platform. Let's move along to the Microsoft-Yahoo merger, and let's have Cord start with a few words about what's been going on that front since Microsoft proposed the idea of merging with Yahoo and the response that it's prompted. Cord?
Well, yeah, the problem is that that Microsoft and Yahoo are respectively the number three and the number two search engines or online advertising companies or whatever Yahoo calls itself these days, a comprehensive network of services and things. Well, regulators want to stand in the way of a number two and three company getting together. This is sort of a unique situation. Google being number one has something like, I don't know, 60% domestically of the search market. Meanwhile, Microsoft and Yahoo combined would be 20, 30% somewhere in there. So even the number two and three getting together, they don't overwhelm the number one company. They barely stack up to a fraction against it. And in the global market, they're like one fifth of the size of of Google, even when combined.
Despite that fact, though, Google has already sort of been out there telling folks, hey, we got to be careful. You know, this is big bad Microsoft we're talking about. We may need to be extra cautious with this, even though Google just got their DoubleClick deal generally approved here in the States. I mean, so Hans, let me turn to you at this point and say, you know, what's your take on this? I mean, it sounds like we've already got politics creeping into this and, you know, a lot of people here in town trying to agitate against a deal even before it's out of the gates.
I just think it's unfortunate that Microsoft opposed the Google DoubleClick merger, and it's unfortunate that Google. I understand tit for tat, you know, it's payback. The guilty must be punished, but it's really too bad. I really believe that the only durable monopoly is one that's, you know, backed by the government, basically, and I just don't think that Microsoft really has much to fear from Google and DoubleClick, and nor does Google have much to fear from Microsoft and Yahoo at all. I just don't see it. So it's really unfortunate that Washington is involved in this at all.
I made the joke to a reporter who called me about this the other day that if Google was smart, they would just go hire all the people that Microsoft had previously hired to file against Google in the DoubleClick proceeding. They can just go hire all the same consultants to file the same paperwork, but replace the name Google with Microsoft, and they could save themselves a lot of money.
Okay.
But Cord or Jerry, any more on this? I mean, what do you think is going to happen? You know, I don't know if News Corp will make the play for them. or not, but any predictions on how this might come out?
You know, it just seems that Microsoft is very serious about getting Google. I mean, they just restructured their management, sort of
getting
ready for it. What I'm curious too is, even if it's approved here in the States, what does the EU do about it? And the EU seems to be very aggressive, and I guess they haven't approved a Google deal yet.
No.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see how more and more the EU is going to sort of dictate what American companies can.
Well, I think another important point here is that, you know, we spend so much time fighting over, you mentioned the EU, Jerry, we spend so much time fighting over the battles of the past in the antitrust world. I mean, the EU is still myopically, you know, focused on browsers and media players.
Media players, for crying out loud. No.
I mean, unbelievable. I mean, to think about the evolution of this market and all the options we have in terms of, you know, media players and browsers. How, I mean, I haven't used IE as a browser in about 5 years. And, you know, and we're obsessing about the battles of the past. So one wonders, well, we'll be having a podcast in, you know, 2018 about the ongoing, you know, Microsoft consent decree when they allied with Yahoo or something.
Right.
Just amazing. Any wrap-up thoughts on that case, guys?
Well, I think that if it's blocked, it'll be unfortunate because I think Microsoft and Yahoo getting together, as much as a lot of experts say that they just have incompatible corporate cultures, and I think Microsoft probably does have to do some reflecting on this and think about hiring some outside consultants so that they don't screw up this merger. But I think if they got together, they could really come up with some cool, novel technologies, really improve their search. Bring down their prices for advertising, and really put some pressure onto Google. I think it would be really good for the market, and I think if they don't get together, if Yahoo doesn't pair with someone, certainly we could see one of these brands go out of existence.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, let's move on to our final issue of the day, which is ongoing efforts to regulate video games. And in this case, there's a new effort to actually tax video games that I've written about this week. In the state of New Mexico, the New Mexico legislature has introduced a new tax measure that would force consumers to pay a 1% excise tax on purchases of video games, gaming consoles, or television sets. And then what's sort of doubly silly about this tax is that the revenue that was supposedly generated from this tax would be used to get kids out of the house more and to do things outdoors or to appreciate outdoors. And they've even used this creative cutesy title for the bill called the Leave No Child Inside Act of 2008. So to me, and I'll ask you guys to comment, I mean, this seems to me to be that sort of the height of elitist, you know, arrogant, paternalistic kind of thinking by a legislature that, you know, we're going to force you or at least tax you to death until you get your kids out of the house more. And as much as I'm for getting the kids out of the house more, and I try to take my kids outside as much as I can, the fact is, using the tax code to accomplish that objective seems like a fairly blunt instrument. Moreover, you know, there's a lot of other things that keep us indoors besides video games. In the essay that I hadn't seen at this week, I pointed out that my daughter is obsessed with Sudoku puzzles, and I'm teaching her right now how to play chess. Hey, that keeps her inside. We better start taxing chess boards and Sudoku books, you know? I mean, so, you know.
I barely go outside, and I don't have any video game consoles. So,
well, what about readers? Are we going to tax books? But Adam,
exactly.
I want to ask you a question. Does that legislation also make the neighborhood safe? I mean, as a parent, one of the concerns I have is my kids playing outside with, sex offenders who are unregistered, living who knows where, crimes getting committed. So does it do anything about that?
Well, that's an interesting point, Hans, because you're pointing out, as I always try to do, you know, regulation is a game of trade-offs, and there are opportunity costs associated with any sort of regulatory activity. Even when it's it's the same sort of situation. I mean, if you tax people to incentivize them to get them to go outside more, there could be downsides as well as upsides. And the folks who favor this legislation, which include the Sierra Club and many other environmental groups, thinks that everybody's just going to run down to their local state park and have a chat with Smokey the Bear. You know, I mean, the fact is that it won't necessarily get anybody to go back to a state park, but the money would go to state parks or to school bureaucracies, and that explains why certain legislators favor it. It's a way to also channel money to favored interests. So, you know, it's just the height of paternalism.
You guys probably know, Adam and Corey, you probably know the demographics of video game players better, but I would imagine that a tax like this would be a bit regressive.
Actually, it's incredibly regressive, and it's quite silly because the average age of a video gamer in this country now is 28 years of age and growing every year by about 1 year of age. And so, you know, we have people like me. I'm 38 years old. I still play video games. Was playing with my kids last night, who are both under the age of 6. And so, does it make any sense? Is the state trying to get me to go outside more? I mean, hell, let me decide that. Let me decide how much I go outside and when with my kids. And, you know, and moreover, it could be regressive in other ways because, you know, people use their video game consoles for other things besides games. I download HD movies now through my Xbox 360 and use it more as a game, as a movie platform than I do as a gaming platform.
I think so.
Go ahead.
No, I think you ought to make a national security argument. I mean, there's no better training for fighter pilots than video. but seriously, I mean, this is a classic example, is it not, of the video game industry becoming a convenient scapegoat for all kinds of problems in our society and shortcomings in our parenting?
That's right. That's exactly right, Hanson. You know, at that point, I want to bring Cord into this because, Cord, you recently released a big paper for CEI with one of your colleagues over there about game issues and rating issues in general and about the growing effort to regulate rating systems. So why don't you just make a mention of that, because it was a great study.
Yeah, well, we compared nearly everything, radio, TV, comic books, video games, movies. So it was a good survey, and we just tried to relate the history of all of those mediums and how government has interacted with the rating or the distribution of those things. And you find that rating systems that are overly prescriptive or just prescriptive codes, like the Hays Code for movies, results in people abandoning those systems. And really, they just don't serve any purpose then. And I think a lot of the interference that we've seen, or attempted interference on the part of people like Hillary Clinton, Joseph Lieberman, Senator Brownback, are all examples of things that are going to push people away from the ESRB system. If some games can just not be released, if we say that that, you know, any game that Hillary Clinton finds particularly offensive can't get an M rating, has to be adults only, and won't be sold in Walmarts or Best Buys or the places that people go to buy games. I think we're going to see things, you know, go online, have people distributing things there where they're not hampered by the ESRB, and also where parents have less control. So it's pretty negative overall, but Wisconsin's also proposed a tax like this, 1% tax that would go to juvenile corrections facilities to fund them. So the correlation there is even worse than the one in Arizona.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you know, the legislation on this front just gets almost more amusing by the day. I mean, I know you guys have followed this as well. The Senator Brownback had a bill last year that's still actually pending in Congress called the Truth in Ratings Act that would actually require someone, I guess the FCC or the FTC, to provide more oversight to the ESRB, but then it would require the ESRB to review every single second of gameplay to search for potentially hidden content, and then it would make it illegal, a federal crime, to have any hidden content or Easter eggs embedded within games before they're rated. I mean, you know, this is an astonishing thing. It shows you how out of touch our legislators are with modern media content, because nobody could sit down and watch every single conceivable second of a video game, because it's not linear like a movie or a TV show, right? I mean, these things can go on forever. I mean, Cord, you're a gaming geek. You play like World of Warcraft and Call of Duty and all that, right? I mean, so, I mean, explain to me, how in the world would that work? Would it work? Could it work?
Well, no, it's Brownback has essentially said play every conceivable game of chess to see if some chess move is suggestive, you know? So it's absolutely ridiculous. And not only that, but games that are pretty linear, like a Halo or something, where you may not be able to shoot every alien in every conceivable position, but you'd at least be able to go through every board, you know, every room and every level. There's so many games now that incorporate, you know, online play and cooperative play, and the ESRB makes sure to state that, you know, content may change in online play, as in someone might swear at you in a chat room or something. You know, so trying to say play every conceivable part of every video game is just insane. I mean, all the supercomputers in the world couldn't do it.
Right. Well, can I ask this? Let me just play devil's advocate here. I think what Brownback's sort of getting at is, like you said, an Easter egg that might have some content that is totally, you know, at an extreme from what is in a normal game, right? That you would have to sort of seek out and unlock to see it, but that would be maybe graphic somehow. Is there any validity to at least finding those things and disclosing that they're in there?
You know, I just mentioned that obviously this was prompted by the hot coffee incident having to do with Grand Theft Auto, where there was a hidden sexual scene that even the developer didn't quite know about before they put the game to market, supposedly.
Right.
And that was corrected, and it was adjudicated by the ESRB and dealt with, and the rating of the game was changed.
Right.
But this, of course, as it always does, you know, regulation in the field of, you know, when it comes to media censorship is always driven by incidents like this. And basically that prompted a lot of concern and people saying, oh my God, our kids could be unlocking all sorts of sexually suggestive or extra violent content. And you know, that realistically, that's probably not the case in most games. But there are these Easter eggs. There are things that are hidden in games. And, you know, just like in the old days, I'm an old geek from the old media age. And back then, we used to try to, you know, run our albums in reverse to check for subliminal messages on our turntables. You know, maybe we should have the government having oversight for RAA or record labels before they release an album to make sure there's no, you know, Paul is dead messages on the Beatles albums or something. I mean, it's just silly. There's going to be hidden content in all sorts of media, DVDs, music, video games. I mean, the government shouldn't be regulating all of that. I mean, that's just silly.
I mean, to answer my own question, if you have to disclose that a game has an Easter egg and what it is, that sort of ruins the surprise and fun of an Easter egg is one
thing.
That's
a good point.
But the other thing is, I think the more important thing is that is what you said, that this was dealt with privately.
Right.
And it was resolved. So.
Right.
Well, not only was Rockstar Games fine, but the ESRB changed its rules afterwards to say that if there's you have to disclose all hidden content, playable or not, and that there's a giant fine, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially, I think. And that was a few months after the hot coffee incident that they changed their rules, saying you can't include this sort of content without disclosing it to us. And that makes sense. And then like 2 years later, Representative Upton of Michigan introduced a bill saying, we want to make it mandatory that video game publishers disclose all pertinent content to the ESRB. You know, so it was a bill that almost exactly phrased the ESRB rule change. So Congress is always like woefully behind.
Yeah, that's right. And it's important to point out that the ESRB, you know, it's criticized a lot by people in Congress, but this is a system that probably is more descriptive, more informative than just about any other rating system and labeling system ever put on the market. And it rates every single game that is produced and marketed in the United States, something like over 1,000 games every year. I have said in my work, in my book on parental controls and online child protection, for example, that it is hard for me to believe that any rating system or labeling system could be more descriptive and easier to use than the ESRB system. And yet here Congress says, well, no, we know what's best. We could do this better, or somehow we'll micromanage it from above. I mean, the problem is we can't forget, this is a voluntary system. Nobody is required to label their games. They are doing it because the system works so efficiently and effectively that, you know, if we were to have the government come in here, that could really just derail the entire system. But some people want that because they want some sort of a universal rating system or a government enforced system. Is that not right, Cord?
Yeah, that's exactly. Hillary Clinton actually proposed that when she was still first lady, that we need that these rating systems are too complicated. You know, because Hillary Clinton just can't underestimate enough the intelligence of the average American. She thinks we're all too stupid to understand the difference between R and M, you know?
Right,
But one thing that experts on this have pointed out is that the ESRB has invested billions of dollars into advertising campaigns to communicate to people, you know, what the rating system is and to get that into the heads of parents. And it's the most widely recognized and widely used system, according to polls of parents. So I think any of these proposals to start, you know, messing around with the system would require, you know, the bill to also include
At this point, the recording crapped out, so I'll just take over for Adam and say thanks to Hans Haney, Cord Blomquist, and myself, I guess, for participating on the show. If you want to leave a comment about what you just heard, just go to techliberation.com/podcast and find the episode number 36 and leave a comment there. Until next time, this is Jerry Prado signing off for Adam Thierer.